So the work we're going to be talking about today describes some work the group has been doing, segregation and hard sphere mixtures. And this work recently came out in JFM, and I'm going to summarize that part of the work, plus some recent additions we've had to that work since it was submitted. And I've tried to also focus a little bit on this talk in terms of some of the unanswered questions that that work gave rise to, and some discussions I'd really like to have with people during the course of the workshop here. I'd like to acknowledge, you probably can't see them, they're way at the bottom of the screen, the students who've been working on this work, Janine Galvin and Stephen Dahl, and also our funding sources, the American Chemical Society, Millennium Chemicals, and Department of Education, who are also getting some supplemental funding. And I'd like to mention Millennium Chemicals a little bit. They've been funding our group for a while, and give inspiration to a lot of the systems we look at. They're a producer of titania, and titania is a pigment that's known for its whiteness and its opaqueness. So it's like a critical component of paints and dyes. Titania, yeah, titanium dioxide. They're used interchangeably. And so one of the unit operations used for the production of titania is a fluidized bed. So it's a gas fluidized bed with two species. The species are the titania ore as well as coke. And obviously the species have different densities. They also have different average sizes. They also have continuous size distributions. They're also reacting, so the particle size distribution is evolving. There's heat transfer, there's reaction. It's an incredibly, incredibly complex system. Luckily, Millennium doesn't have expectations that we're going to model that system anytime soon. But they've been very supportive of giving us money so we could look at more simplified systems and try to understand the physics associated with those. So one of the things we're looking at that's related to that system is mixing and segregation in systems that have non-uniform particles. And we've been doing that both for fluidized beds as well as for granular systems to try to understand both of them. And the work I'll be presenting today is focused on the granular systems. So with that in mind, when we started this project several years back, 3 or 4 years ago, we obviously looked to the literature for the work that had been done in segregation for granular mixtures. And one of the earliest efforts was by Melanie Hunt's group. And they used a theory that had been proposed by Jim Jenkins and his group. And we're looking at thermal segregation. What I mean by thermal segregation, it was segregation in the presence of a temperature gradient only. There were no external forces on the system. So their only driving force for the segregation was that temperature gradient. And basically what they found is that using that theory, that large particles, or more massive particles, I should say, prefer regions of lower granular temperature. All the particles segregate towards it, and they just segregate preferentially towards it. There's some work that I'm sure everyone here is familiar with by Jim Jenkins, Michelle Luge, and their collaborator Arneson. And they did a really nice combination of theory simulations and experiments. This was the microgravity work in their shear cell that they looked at. And what they found was a really nice comparison between Jim Jenkins' theory for binary mixtures, as well as some molecular dynamic simulations they carried out, and as well as some experiments. I should say, I've tried to list here just the research groups and not all of the authors, and I apologize for that, but it was just for the sake of brevity. I have split out the work, though, of Jenkins and Yoon, and this is recently appeared, I believe, in PRL in 2002, just because this one had a little bit twist, a little bit different twist than the other ones listed up here, and that is they were looking at segregation in the presence of an external force field, namely gravitational field, but no granular temperature gradient. So they were looking at a different driving force for this type of segregation. There have also been several simulation contributions. Luding basically confirmed the qualitative results that Hunt found, that is that large particles preferentially segregate into low temperature regions. We extended that work to continuous particle size distributions. Again, the motivation for this was the sorts of applications Millennium was interested in. And there's been some interesting recent work by Marconi's group looking at segregation in clustering systems, and particularly homogeneous cooling systems, the sort of transients we see there and how segregation behaves in those systems. So when we started this work, what we found, or what we could summarize in these previous contributions is that all of these theoretical contributions, namely that by Melanie Hunt and the work by Jim Jenkins as well, have been based on kinetic theories that all had an equipartition of energy assumption. And although there was a good comparison between the work of Jim Jenkins and Michelle Luge, between their theory and the simulations and experiments, they were restricted to relatively low mass ratios, and that's a region where we don't expect a high level of equipartition. I believe, and Jim can correct me if I'm wrong, that the mass ratios were limited to about 2 for those systems, but roughly speaking. And I'll talk about the impact of that in a little bit. And I should say, just for the sake of completeness, I've put the one exception to those notes up here, and that is Javier's talk last week. who, of course, has interests similar to ours in terms of the effect of non-ethical partition on the segregation effect. And he, too, was looking at what I've labeled the thermal segregation. So essentially, that's what we wanted to do, is get some sense of how much influence non-ethical partition would have on this species segregation, and if it would be important in realistic systems. And clearly, we know there's been, everyone here in the room is familiar with a large number of experiments, theory, and simulations that have shown that there is non-ethical partition in these systems. I've pulled here some simulations just because it was easy to pull them from our own work, but all of these works show similar trends, and that is that as if we look at the temperature ratio, and this is between the more massive to the less massive particle, as we decrease the restitution coefficients, or we become more inelastic, or we increase the mass ratio, I should say it's probably fewer next than the diameter ratio, we're going to increase this level of non-ethical partition. So we see at moderate restitution coefficients, at fairly high levels of the mass ratio, because we have to cube this essentially, a mass ratio of 2 would be somewhere in this region here, you still have nearly ethical partition. I should say this is for a simple shear flow system, so this isn't true of all systems, but it's at least an indicator. But as we get over into this region, we see things become, non-ethical partition becomes more apparent. And so the questions we were trying to ask ourselves again is, what is the impact of non-ethical partition on segregation? And again, related to forks and millennium, is it important in practical systems? Is it always going to be orders of magnitude different than the other driving forces we have, or do we think it's going to be important in systems we're interested in? Yeah.
Is that diameter or mass?
I plotted it as diameter ratio, but I think a more true index, based on some of the follow-up work that Ludin's group had done, a mass ratio would be the best indicator of that difference in non-ethical partition. So that's why I'm making that distinction. I just pulled this because it was easy, and that's what we had done.
Yeah. The anisotropy is similar in magnitude to the
Is the anisotropy in
the string wise and plus string?
You know, I'm not sure, to be honest. We didn't check that in the system. Yeah, it's something we could easily check in our simulation, so we don't have a sense for the level of anisotropy. So in addition to that general motivation that I already talked about, one important practical implication of the answer to this question is whether we're going to need to use a multi-temperature theory as you would for a system which display reasonable amounts of non-ethical partition versus a single-temperature theory if we could make an equipartition assumption. The single-temperature theory, because you know the relationship between all the species temperatures, you'd only have to solve one granular energy balance instead of many granular energy balances, which you'd need if there is significant non-ethical partition. And it turns out to, as you can imagine, have a significant impact on the computational expense. So that's one practical reason why we wanted to answer this question. And our approach here is to compare a theory, and one theory which does have non-ethical partition effects so that we can turn those effects on and off, and compare it to simulation or experiment. Since we're easily set up for simulations and we were aware of experiments that really have pushed the envelope on this mass ratio and looked at large levels of non-ethical partition, we did this comparison from theory to simulations that we had performed. So I want to quickly review the theories that were available when we started this work. There was an early contribution by Jim Jenkins, traces back to 1987, which, although Maxwellian velocity distribution was assumed, they did account for non-ethical partition effects in that theory. Shortly after that, several theories reversed kind of these, I'll call them reverse the assumptions, I'm overstating that a little bit, but I think you get the meaning of what I'm talking about here. So this one is really the one we were looking towards in terms of comparing it. The interesting thing about this theory is that although it had been put out quite a while ago for non-ethical partition, whenever it had been used in the literature that followed it, they had always imposed an ethical partition assumption before applying it to their system. So nobody really got a sense of how good it could predict non-ethical partition or what those non-ethical partition effects were. We had started this work slightly before Garzin Duffy's contribution came out, which does allow for both non-Maxwellian and non-ethical partition effects. Although we decided not to compare with that one because it is restricted to dilute systems. And you'll see we go to fairly high volume fractions. And we're interested in that, again, because of who we're working with, the Millennium Chemicals. So just a quick review. So this very early theory of Jim Jenkins is the one we chose to compare against. And I would like to bring it up, just because I'd like to talk to some people here about this. And I've already fed this paper to a few people. There's a recent theory that just came out in the AICHE journal just a couple of weeks ago, I believe, by Adir and Rasipur. Rasipur is a chemical engineering professor at Illinois Institute of Technology. So I guess the other IIT is how we talk about it. And this applies to both dilute and dense systems and has essentially both non-maxwellian and non-inconsistent effects. So the analysis I'll describe today, we're currently in the process of repeating with this new theory, but I'd like to talk to some folks about this theory. It actually compares quite well with some simulations, but we can talk about that a little bit later. It's a little bit off topic. So one of the things we wanted to do is, like I said, the Jenkins and Mancini had early non-echo partition theory. We first wanted to assess quantitatively how good it could predict non-echo partition. It hadn't been tested before. So the red data points here are the results from RMD simulations, again, for a simple shear flow system. I have some system parameters down in the bottom left-hand corner, solids fraction and solids fraction ratio between the large and small particles. And we see these blue lines are just the predictions from that non-echo partition theory. And the dots are, of course, RMD simulations, that the theory does quite a good job of predicting the level of non-echo partition in the system, even at fairly large diameter ratios and low restitution coefficients. This is essentially the same parameter space I showed before. Now, unexpectedly, it underpredicts the stress at both the shear and normal components due to that Maxwellian velocity distribution. This is shown by Willits and Arneson, that you will get an increase when you account for those non-Maxwellian effects. So quantitatively, it predicts the level of non-echo partition well. The stress is slightly underpredicted. And I'll come back to this point a little bit later because it affects how we analyze things and our interpretation of these results. And you just keep those in mind. So the next thing we ask ourselves is, using this theory, what impact will non-echo partition have on the segregation? So to that, we look to the diffusion velocity equation, and this is mimicking the previous efforts, and actually this is a summary of those previous efforts by Melanie Hunsfield and Jim Jenkins. And what you have is the difference in the diffusion velocities equals, I didn't put all the dependencies of the transport coefficients here because I think people are familiar with what those dependencies are in general, and it would just have made the equation a lot messier. But we have that diffusion coefficient. What I'd like to draw your attention to is the different driving forces here. We have the pressure gradients associated with both the species, the external forces, a mixture granular temperature gradient, and gradients associated with each of the number of concentrations of those particles. And so a key assumption here in the derivation of this equation, which will dictate segregation, is that there is an equipartition of energy. And if we essentially derive the same diffusion velocity equation using that earlier theory, that non-equipartition theory of Jim's, what we find is it gives rise to two new terms. And these terms, the notation I use here is P because they do come from the pressure terms, but they depend on the species granular temperatures as opposed to just the mixture temperatures, which these two do. Okay? And so these are the non-echo partition effects. And essentially what we want to do is get an estimate of what the size of these terms are relative to all of the other terms that are dictating segregation in the system. And so to do that, what we did is we compared with MD simulations, and I'll describe the simulations in a minute. We collected profiles across those domains for everything we need here, things like granular temperature, species concentrations, other species pressures, et cetera. And then we made estimates, just basically finite differencing to make approximations for these gradients so that we can compare the order of magnitude associated with all of those terms. Now, one thing you might ask yourselves is why didn't we do a numerical solution of the hydrodynamic equations and then compare those predictions directly to our MD simulations? And you didn't feel that that level, that fineness, if you will, of a comparison was a fair one because this is a theory, like I said, that we know is going to have some quantitative limitations in terms of the stress predictions, the pressure predictions, et cetera. So we really just wanted to gauge the ballpark effect and not go beyond that because we didn't think it was fair for the theory we were using. So for the simulations, again, the basic idea is to use the profiles obtained from the simulations to compare the order of magnitude associated with those different terms. The system is the simplest one we could think of in which we had a granular temperature gradient and we get segregation, but we wouldn't make things any more complex than they needed to be. So basically, what we have is a three-dimensional simulation. One wall is cold, and by that I, of course, mean granular temperature. The other wall is hot. The other four faces are just periodic in nature. So there's no mean flow. There's no external forces that are causing segregation. We simply have a gradient in temperature from left to right. The boundary conditions, I'd just like to take a short break to talk about what we did here. They are walls of unequal constant temperature. We tried a lot of different boundary conditions because we wanted to ensure that these results are not sensitive to the boundary conditions. We had Maxwellian velocity distributions associated with those temperatures, non-Maxwellian velocities associated with those temperatures, equipartition, non-equipartition. Regardless of the type of boundary condition we put in there, we found that the profiles were only mildly sensitive to that boundary condition right in the immediate boundary region, but the interior of the results basically didn't change at all. So they were insensitive, and that's where we're drawing most of our conclusions from. So I just wanted to stress the insensitivity to those boundary conditions. To mimic what the assumptions of good kinetic theory, we're using inelastic frictionless particles. We do have hard spheres, so we have binary and instantaneous collisions here. Data collection, we were really careful about this, and I'll explain why later. This gives rise to one of the peculiar behaviors or unexpected behaviors that we got from the system. But we did a combined space-time averaging to make sure we were separating out the peculiar velocity, which is important for the granular temperature, from the local mean velocity, if there was one that was important. And again, I'll talk about this a little bit more later. And then finally, we're just recording those profiles as a function of x across the domain. Yes?
Yeah. I'm sorry, I just had a little difficulty visualizing one thing here. How do you couple, so you impose these temperatures on these walls, what's the mechanism by which you couple that with the particles? What do you do when...
So when a particle hits the wall is when we're actually imposing that boundary condition. It propagates throughout the interior of the domain through other collisions with particles.
Right, so do they just acquire a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution?
That was one of the boundary conditions we used. Yeah, so one of the boundary conditions we used is whenever a particle hits this left wall, all the particles exiting that wall would get a Maxwellian distribution associated with that temperature. And that's when we played with the non-Maxwellian, the non-equipartition versus equipartition, but we didn't see sensitivity.
When you say Maxwellian, you mean flux-weighted Maxwellian?
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, famously, the mean kinetic energy of particles crossing a surface is, for example, not 3.5 kT, but 2 kT, because there's a speed factor in the flux.
And I'd be happy to share boundary conditions we used with this one. It was basically when we used the non-Maxwellian ones, they were Maxwellian in the direction that was parallel to the boundary, and then it was non-Maxwellian perpendicular to the boundary. And this was actually a boundary condition that was suggested to us by one of the reviewers, but we went through a whole lot of them, and I'd be happy to share the details of them with you. I don't have them listed up here. Any questions? And so I'm going to cut right to the chase here and then kind of get to some of the interesting stuff that I think might give some rise to some good discussion through the course of the workshop. Basically, this is one of the systems we looked at. We looked at a large parameter space. So we have an overall volume fraction of 0.2, restitution coefficient of 0.9. The diameter ratio of the particles is 2, and the density ratio is also 2. So if we cube this and then multiply by the density ratio, we have a mass ratio of 16. So that's what we're looking at with the system. Again, that's representative of something that the company we're working with is interested in. We have a temperature gradient across the domain. The ratio, I should say, between the hot temperature wall and the cold temperature wall is 10, and so that's the system we're looking at. This is a snapshot of it, so as we expect, all the particles are generally congregating. We have a high volume fraction in the cold wall region. We see a preferential segregation of the large particles, or the massive particles, I should say, relative to the light particles, which are relatively homogeneous throughout that system. And I'll show profiles of those volume fractions and temperature ratios later. But again, just kind of cutting to the chase, when we compared the magnitude of the driving forces, so in the previous couple slides ago when I showed all of the driving forces associated with segregation, there were two associated with non-equipartition. One of them is this dark blue line. And so we see that its order of magnitude is very close, and it is the same order of magnitude as those other driving forces, which indicates that these effects are important, at least in this system. The remaining question we have is, as we apply it to a more practical system, will those effects also be important? So that was the gist of that part of it. And of course, I should say these effects, the relative location of this line relative to the other driving forces is going to decrease as you increase the elasticity of the system or decrease the mass ratio of the system. So if you do the same sorts of things that are going to decrease the level of non-equipartition or increase, or as we approach equipartition, the relative magnitude of those driving forces will attenuate. Okay, so obviously it's give and take depending on the parameters of your system. So an interesting observation is actually down here, but I'll start up here. This is the solid fraction profile associated with the same system that I just showed in the previous slide. And we've normalized those with the volume fraction if those particular particles were homogeneously distributed in the system. So if all of these lines rested at one, that means all of the particles would have been homogeneously distributed through the system. The dark blue line on top is then associated with a large particle. So large particles are roughly three times their particular volume fraction in the overall system. And we see that the overall system, which is the red line, again, you see an overall segregation towards that cold region of the small, or the light particles, I should say, you see actually are not preferentially segregating in this region and are actually preferentially segregating a little bit outside that region. Okay? So again, this is consistent with what other people had seen. A new observation that we saw that, in all honesty, when we first saw it, we thought it was a bug in our simulation. Then we looked at it really hard, and I now believe that it's not a bug, is the non-equipartition. And in particular, what we're seeing here, we're plotting the temperature of the heavy particle relative to the light particle. And so we see that it's high in this dense region of the system over to the left. And we actually get a dip below one in a portion of the domain. And this portion of the domain really is right here. It's right at the interface between the dense and the dilute region. And what's unique about this is that as far as we know, previous simulations, experiments, and theoretical predictions have always shown that the heavier particle has a higher temperature than the light particle, where in this region where it's below one, we're actually showing the opposite. The one exception to that is some work done by Barat. And what they found is they did have this behavior, but what we attribute it to is the fact that the restitution coefficient of the particle, the heavy particle, was also less than that of the light particle. So it makes sense in that system. Whereas here, we have a constant restitution coefficient between all the particles of our system. Okay? So this is fairly unique. So like I said, when we first saw this, we thought it may be something we're doing in the simulations. And so what we thought it may be was averaging. Because at this point, when we first started this work, we're basically just averaging over snapshots that were separated by space and time, by significant space and time, I should say, and took the average of many, many of those snapshots. And one thing we thought about is we looked at these simulations and looked at movies of them, and I apologize, I don't have a movie of them, is that, you know, there are regions here, you know, there's not just a straight region here where we have dense and dilute. This interface is slightly moving around. And we wondered if there was a significant enough local motion here that we weren't subtracting out before we were calculating the granular temperature. So we wanted to make sure we're getting the peculiar velocity. And this is where we were really careful doing our averaging. We did some really arduous space-time averaging to ensure that we were didn't have significant local velocities, or I should say that we were calculating them, subtracting them out, then recalculating that granular temperature. And it actually didn't change this curve much at all, indicating that we didn't have much of local velocity. But I feel very confident that we are capturing the correct granular temperature ratio here. So this was an aside to the thrust of our work. So we didn't investigate this a lot, and this is why I'd like to talk to people here about it. One physical explanation for this, and we have no evidence for or against, it's just a physical explanation I'm throwing out there, is that if we look at this region where we see this dip in this temperature ratio right here, we can imagine a scenario where most of the cold particles in this region might be, or excuse me, most of the massive particles in this region might be coming from the left, because that's where most of the massive particles are. Most of the lighter particles are coming from this region, because that's where more of the lighter particles are. And if they approach this region where we see this dip, if they don't engage in enough collisions before exiting that area, the source for the massive particles is a cooler region, and the source for the lighter particles is a higher temperature region. So we would see that dip. Now this is a little bit different than the explanation that Javier Bray was talking about last week, in which he posited that not a compartition would achieve a local equilibrium. And we're actually, the explanation I just gave is saying it's not reaching local equilibrium. So I think it's an unanswered question that we still need to resolve one way or the other. And I'd be curious if anyone is familiar with or interested in experiments that might be able to measure this sort of behavior, which we'd expect at the interface between a very dense and a very dynamic system, as well as if there's any theories that can predict it and hopefully give us some further insight on the physical mechanisms here. I would like to say that one reason we're interested in this, although this is a fairly idealized system, we are interested in clustering systems. And one of the reasons we're interested in clustering systems is if we think back to that fluidized bed I was talking about, in the freeboard section above the bubbling bed part, you actually see these transient clusters and streamers that are very reminiscent of the types of patterns you see in granular flows only. And clearly, this type of behavior is reminiscent of the interface between a cluster and a system, or between a cluster and a non-clustered region. We expect a big temperature difference between those two. We expect the temperature here to be much lower because of all the collisions, and to be much higher here. So we do think it has practical applications as well. So that's one. David?
Oh, I was just wondering, to kind of maybe address that issue, would it make sense to, here in the system, over the whole system, the gradients are fairly large. It's not
really
go up and down. I mean, kind of in the spirit of what you're saying, what if I took out just a slice you're interested in, and just simulate that with those concentrations, those local concentrations, and those local independent temperature gradients, one for each species, so, would you expect to get?
So it's a system without gradients?
No, with gradients. So like just take that slice that you're interested in, say, and just simulate that. And you've measured the temperature, the gradient temperature for each species here. So apply those gradient temperatures to boundary conditions, kind of this focus small simulation.
Okay.
Do you think that would that be? I mean, could I take this inhomogeneous system and simulate kind of slices of more systems which are more homogeneous in a sense?
So the only thing I'm not following is that if I do take a small slice of it, right, and it's still going to have a temperature gradient. It's still going to be a significant temperature gradient. So I guess I'm not sure what I'm buying because I'm just applying those boundary conditions here. The other concern I have about doing a really thin system is, like I said, the profiles in the near wall region are going to depend slightly on those boundary conditions, but as I make those boundary conditions more important by making the system smaller and smaller, it might introduce boundary effects that I don't want to introduce.
I mean, you have to have a flux going from right to left, and there's a large number of small particles on the right and large particles on the left, so obviously, unless there's a temperature gradient, you cannot have a flux going left.
I cannot have flux going.
You have to have a flux going from right to left.
I mean, I do have a granular temperature. I can draw. I forgot to put the granular temperature profile up. So basically, what it's going to look like. So this is just mixture temperature from the left-hand wall. It'll dip down due to the inelasticities, the dissipative nature of the collisions, and come back up here. It's too hot.
You have a segregation of particles on both sides of that dip. So if you have larger number of small particles on the right and large particles on the left, there has to be a temperature gradient between the two in order to generate the flux.
I don't know that I would agree with that. If we look back at the governing equations, and we might want to talk about this in more detail offline. But is there anything in these equations that is telling you that that's the case? I mean, that's why I said I want to look at them in more detail as well, because I see where you're going with it, but I don't know that the equations dictate that.
And
I should say,
yeah, I was going to say, there's another possibility is in some of the theories, like Gray's, for example, you get the density-dependent term in the temperature equations, the heat flux. You have a T, just gradient of the density change. There's a huge density change there in dense particles.
Yeah, there is.
And that may be doing it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
is that like that? Does that have the right side or the wrong side?
What I would say, I would go back to 5 years picture before looking at the fluxes and just take the given thermodynamic parameters. As you say, the temperature ratio depends on the density, but it also depends on the compositions. So all of those are changing dramatically.
Right. And we did a comparison based on your homogeneous cooling prediction for the dense system based on Javier's work last week. And what we found was that the prediction of that, it was always above one, which is the key thing. It didn't show the minimum. Qualitatively, it was correct, but it looked something more like this. So it didn't pick up nearly the magnitude that we're seeing in the temperature ratio. Of course, this is a very dense system. We have very high volume fractions here. But it didn't pick this up, and this is in a volume fraction region, which I expect, and we showed comparing with the earlier MD simulations that that would hold, because the volume fraction ratio here is right about the average for the system, which is 0.2. And so it wasn't able to pick up that minimum, nor the magnitude associated here. But this one isn't surprising, but this one surprised me a little bit. But that's a brand new comparison we make, so we've still got to think through it a little bit.
Yeah. Can I ask a question that's related to something you've done earlier? So this is a system where you prescribe temperatures on both boundaries, but Javier said that there was a difficulty with as far as the kinetic theory goes. Do we understand
that? I don't. Maybe Javier is
here's the system. You mentioned.
I mentioned is that in the one-dimensional case that was studied first by Grossman, Ben-Naim, I think, I don't know, many years ago, maybe 15 years ago, even in that case they found that even when the restitution coefficient was very close to one, just in the center of the system it appears a dip in the pressure profile that not one has been able to explain up to now. So in some sense that in the there are some difficulties to describe the system at the hydrodynamic level, even if you go up to Barnett order, even to higher orders. In some sense, it's because the walls are playing a role near the walls, but the center of the system, you always have difficulty in describing that hydrodynamically. From a practical point of view, I don't know how I'm able to explain that, but I have the feeling that in some sense, the boundary layer is just in the center of the city, of the system, although the walls are at the borders of the system, because the walls are projecting all the particles just toward the center of the system, and that is what will create something that cannot be described by the dimension. That is what I meant that in this case, for the one, even for the one component system, I don't know too much about the two component system.
So just a quick clarification, you're prescribing only the temperature of the reflected particles, right?
Yes.
So it's, the average temperature is not.
That's correct.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the difficulties are clear in the temperature profile that's drawn on the blackboard there. But, the energy damping is lowering the temperature as you go in from the left-hand side rather than beating the imposed overall temperature gradient.
But you would expect that just due to the dissipative nature of the collisions. Both walls are acting as a source. One is just a stronger source than the other.
Well, the cold wall may or may not actually, I guess it looks like that it's the source. It wouldn't necessarily have to
be. The way we have it set up, that's correct.
Do you have the pressure profile?
I do not have the pressure profile, but I can easily put that together.
We saw the difficulty.
Yeah. And we have the profiles, we could easily do that, so I'd be curious to see if that is what we're seeing here as well. Anyways, I have two more slides, but they introduce something new. I don't know if we want to keep going. Bob?
So, quick question.
It should be.
And then we revert to classical kinetic theory and simple diffusion.
That's correct.
Yeah, this has a state change.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to switch gears just a little bit and try to introduce one other thing fast. It doesn't look, shouldn't look that way. Oh, there we go. Okay, I don't know what happened then. Anyways, same system, but this time we did continuous size distributions instead of binary distributions. And again, our motivation for that was this company we're working with. One of the beauties of binary distributions is even when you have segregation, wherever you go locally in the system, it's still a binary distribution. A priori, we don't know that about a continuous distribution, if it's log-normal or Gaussian. Overall, when you throw that bit of particles in, when you let them segregate, what is the local nature of that profile going to look like? And what we found is that in these systems, we have the same sort of behavior. This is a Gaussian system, a log-normal system. These are particle size distribution histograms. Near the hot wall on the left-hand side, near the cold wall on the right-hand side. And so you see we do have, as you'd expect, that the large particles prefer the cold region, and that's why you see it shifted in the average diameter as we go from the cold wall to the hot wall. But the more interesting thing we saw here is that the shape of the distribution actually mimics that of the overall size distribution, regardless of whether you start with a Gaussian or a log normal. We weren't sure if this was due to some idealized nature of the system, so we just did kind of a leap ahead and looked at a much more complicated system. Again, this is motivated from the Millennium. And this is a fluidized bed simulation. So this simulation, I'm trying to get it started here, is a gas fluidized bed. It's a binary mixture. How we're simulating it is the particles are simulated in a discrete nature, just as in molecular dynamics simulations. We're coupling it with a continuum approach or a continuum description of the fluid phase. The two are coupled via drag force. We're not looking at any other particle fluid interactions. So what you see here, and this is going faster than real time, which is why it looks faster than real time, but you get the bubbling instabilities that you'd expect for this type of system. This is just in 2D for computational reasons. I'm going to do it one more time, so you can kind of see that the large particles are segregating near the bottom, which I'll show over here quantitatively as well. So that's the basic nature of this fluidized bed. What we're looking at here are four different points in the fluidized bed and looking at the local particle size distribution histograms again. And this we started with a Gaussian type distribution, and we see that as we go down in the bed, again this corresponds to these four points, that we maintain the shape of that distribution, though of course its statistics change, its average diameter is going to go up as we go down in the bed, and also the standard deviation can change. So we at least see that this mimicking of the shape of the local size distribution to that of the overall size distribution happens in a range of systems, a very simple granular flow system and a much more complex fluidized bed system. And so the question we ask ourselves that's purely observational at this point is, do we think theories that are extended from two particle systems to a number of discrete particle sizes would be able to pick up something like this? Or perhaps even more importantly in the long term, would we be able to use this sort of observation to simplify how we're approaching the kinetic theory for such distributions, for continuous size distributions. And so that's something we've been thinking about a little bit and ways we might be able to do that, but I'd be curious what other folks think as well and like to have those conversations if people are interested. So with that, I will just go ahead and, I'm sorry I took a little bit longer than my time. I won't go through this, but these are sorts of the questions and issues that I think are what gave rise to that I'd like to talk to people about. Thank you.
Christine, talking about continuous size distribution, what do you actually do? How many sizes do you use?
Oh, so we use a Box-Mueller method, which is a statistical method of generating that size distribution, and we basically just make sure that we have enough particles in the system so it looks smooth. Yeah, when we sample it.
What do you simulate the fluid in the last?
How do we simulate the fluid? We're basically solving the Navier-Stokes equation that's augmented for the drag force of the particles. It's not, I mean, we're not solving for the level of detail of the fluid flow around each individual particles, which I think is what you're referring to by VNS. Now, basically, this is one cell in the CFD simulation, and there'd be several particles here. And so this is one fluid cell, but we're solving for individual particles. So we'd map the Bond fraction of that into the fluid phase and basically take the averages over this.
What forces on the Bond system?
That's correct. Yeah, for the drag forces. Yep.
What drag force model can we use?
We tried a couple of different ones for this. There are a couple new ones in the literature for binary systems, and those are the ones we use in this. So they were modified from the monodisperse. They're empirical in nature, all of them are.
Yeah. What would be the expectation for system bimodal?
For the fluidized bed?
Yes.
Okay, and by bimodal you don't mean bidisperse, but you
create bimodal, which is two
maximum. Yeah. I have a hard time. I would just be guessing, hitting a stab in the dark. I assume at some limit it would behave similar to the system. We did some binary size distribution for the fluidized bed as well. We also saw large particles going towards the bottom. But I don't know if that answers your question or not. Okay. Thanks, everybody.